Hello, ladies and gentlemen. This is Dan Trotter, Pretty Good Bible Studies. I am now in 2 Samuel chapter 5. The whole chapter we'll do this time, verses 1 through 25, and we will see David anointed as king of Israel. Our context is this. Two chapters ago in 2 Samuel 3, we saw that David's general Joab murdered Israel's general Abner, thus taking care of northern Israel's military commander, which of course helped David out in the long run. Of course, in the short run, it was a political embarrassment because David did not mean for Joab to do that. Joab did it on the sly and thus put confusion in the house of Israel. But then in chapter 4, we see that Ishbosheth, king of Israel, remember David's the king of Judah, one tribe, Israel is all the other northern tribes, and Ishbosheth, Saul's fourth son, the inheritor of the kingdom of Saul, he was murdered by Baana and Rechab, two military commanders. And so now the king of Israel's gone. So David's sitting pretty. And the leaders of the tribes of Israel, the other 11 tribes besides Judah, they realize that the writing is on the wall. And so we start now with 2 Samuel 5, verses 1 through 3. Then all the tribes of Israel came to David at Hebron and said, "Behold, we are your bone and your flesh. Previously, when Saul was king over us, you were the one who led Israel out and in. And the Lord said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel, and you will be a ruler over Israel.' So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them before the Lord at Hebron. Then they anointed David king over Israel." Now, when all the tribes of Israel came to David, that of course did not include Judah, because Judah was already with David at Hebron. They had already made him king in Hebron 7 years ago. By the way, the timeline for this, according to BibleHub.com timeline, is 1010, David is anointed ruler of Judah, and then he rules in Hebron as ruler of Judah for seven and a half years from 1010 to 1003, and at 1003, he's anointed king over all Israel, northern 11 tribes as well as the south, and that's where we are now. So this is roughly, assuming the timeline is right, which of course you can't. Those things are not that accurate, but we're roughly around 1003 BC as David prepares to be anointed. Now, because all the tribes of Israel came down to David at Hebron, this shows that David had managed to clear himself of implication in the murders of Abner and Ishbosheth. He had nothing to do with hiring Baana and Rechab to kill Ishbosheth, nor did he have anything to do with Joab killing Abner, but it sure looked bad, especially in the case of Joab. But you remember, Joab buried Abner with great pomp and ceremony, walked behind the coffin at the funeral and wrote a song, a lament, and sang it. Oh, Abner, the greatest man that ever lived, and so forth. And so the people of Israel know that David did not engage in treachery against Israel. As a matter of fact, the elders of the other 11 tribes would probably have gone straight over to David as soon as Saul and Jonathan had gotten killed at the Battle of Gilboa by the Philistines. But Abner probably interposed and put Ishbosheth on the throne so Abner could still be the military leader. At any rate, where are the elders of Israel going to go now? They've lost their king. They've lost their general. They've got no choice, really. David was their common countryman. "We are your bone and your flesh," they say. David had always led the Israelites to victory when he was working for Saul as Saul's general. And in fact, God had anointed David through Samuel, as they say in verse 2. "The Lord said to you, 'You will shepherd my people Israel.'" So there's a lot of reasons for the elders to come over to Israel. So this is a logical process here. Now, when the elders of the tribes of Israel told David, "We are your bone and your flesh," this shows that Israel was more than just an association of tribes. They all had an idea of the common unity which bound them together despite all the tribal divisions. Now, they're quoting the Lord as saying that, "David, you're going to shepherd my people Israel." Notice not Judah, but Israel. That's all of them. They're quoting Samuel's prophecy, not word for word, of course. This is referring to when Samuel had anointed David in Jesse's house down in Bethlehem when David was just a young shepherd boy, probably a teenager. This thing had become famous in Israel. Everybody knew it. In fact, it's amazing to me that since everybody knew it, Saul knew it, Abner knew it, Ishbosheth knew it, but they still kept right on with the old ways, which I guess is an illustration of human nature. So all the elders of Israel came to the king at Hebron, and King David made a covenant with them before the Lord. Now, what does that mean? Before the ark? No, the ark is at Kiriath-Jearim to the west, a little ways, west of Jerusalem. The ark was later brought from Kiriath-Jearim to Jerusalem. So what does it mean that David made the covenant with the tribal leaders of Israel at Hebron before the Lord? Well, it just means in a public assembly of Israel, the Lord was considered to be there, as John Gill says. The anointed David king over Israel, of course, anointing a king is what you do to prophet, priest, and kings. This is the third time David was anointed. The first time was by Samuel at Jesse's house in Bethlehem, 1 Samuel 16:13. So Samuel took the horn of oil, anointed him, anointed David in the presence of his brothers, and the Spirit of the Lord took control of David from that day forward. The second time David was anointed was by the tribe of Judah as king over Judah. That one tribe of Judah, that's when David ruled over Judah from Hebron, south of Jerusalem. 2 Samuel 2:4, then the men of Judah came, and they anointed David king over the house of Judah. So David is the thrice anointed one. Now, this anointing was done in front of the elders of the tribes, but John Gill says there were more than just the elders there, that there were a great number of people from several tribes. I don't know how he knows that, but John Gill seems to know just about everything. So we'll take his word on it. On that, it makes sense that more people than the king, than the elders would come. I would imagine a lot of clan leaders, a lot of family leaders might be there. At any rate, David is now king over the whole Shmear, the whole kingdom. And notice a covenant has been made. That's typical. A covenant is usually made at the beginning of a new dynasty. Jameson Fawcett says, covenant is usually made at the beginning of a new dynasty, not necessarily a new king, but a new dynasty. And sometimes, due to special circumstances, a covenant was made at the beginning of a new king's reign. In other words, whenever they wanted something really special to be cemented in stone, they would make a covenant. 2 Samuel 5, verses 4 through 5. David was 30 years old when he became king, and he reigned 40 years. At Hebron, he reigned over Judah 7 years and 6 months, and in Jerusalem, he reigned 33 years over all Israel and Judah. Now, that 40 years is a round number. Obviously, you can add up the time periods in these two verses, and you get 40 and a half, 30 years old in Jerusalem, 7 and a half in Hebron for 40 and a half. So 40 years is a round off figure from 40 years and 6 months. The rabbis try to explain that rounding by saying David fled 6 months from Absalom, so you don't count that reign there during the civil war with Absalom. I don't think that's necessary. Another way the rabbis try to reconcile it, they say that David was ill in Hebron, and so we're not going to count 6 months in Hebron when he was sick. There's no point in that. It's just a round number. All of these years show that David was about 38 years when he began to rule over all of Israel, as John Gill says, maybe 39. Says he was 30 when he became king in Hebron. He had 7.5 years to that. Okay, 38, excuse me, I shouldn't say 39. 37 or 38 years, Gill says about 38. Well, if he's 38 years, and when he reigned, 38 years old when he took office, and he ruled for 40 years, 38 plus 40 is 78. So we get a feel for how old David was when he died. And 78's not that old for kings back then in the old days. Of course, David had a pretty rough life. I might have probably taken some of his health away. We go down to 2 Samuel 5, 6 through 7. Now the king and his men went to Jerusalem against the Jebusites, the inhabitants of the land. And they said to David, "You shall not come in here, but the blind and lame will turn you away," thinking, "David cannot enter here." Nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion, that is, the city of David. Now, this is the famous place where David took Jerusalem from the Jebusites. Now, the history of Jerusalem and its inhabitants is sort of complicated, and I'm going to get into that in just a minute. But let's look at now, why had not David gone to take Jerusalem before this? Well, Jerusalem is a highly fortified place. It was partly owned by Benjamin, and Benjamin was not submitted to David while David was at Hebron. And plus, there were Jebusites there, too. So, that's why it wasn't taken by David earlier than this. Well, now, why did David want to make Jerusalem his capital? This is from the NIV Study Bible. The strategic reasons. Jerusalem is just 5 or 6 miles from David's hometown of Bethlehem, just north of Bethlehem. It was a strategic military location. It was situated in the heart of the Promised Land. It was accessible to both northern and southern tribes, which would help unite the people when David captured it. So that's why he wanted Jerusalem. Now let's look at the history of Jerusalem. First of all, it was called Salem back in ancient times, patriarchal times, Abraham's time, when Melchizedek was king. Remember, he was king of Salem. Well, that's Jerusalem. Salem means peace. Now Joshua, when he came in, he found out that Jerusalem, or Jebus as it was called, was the chief city in the south of Canaan in Joshua 10. When Joshua divvied up the land by lot, Benjamin received Jerusalem by lot, but Judah got land that was basically part of Jerusalem. It's kind of interesting. The dividing line between Benjamin and Jerusalem is basically right through the middle of the city. So, after Joshua died at the very beginning of Judges, the children of Judah had taken Jerusalem. But then the children of Benjamin suffered the Jebusites to dwell among them. So Judah and Benjamin were in Jerusalem, and then the Jebusites came back and lived there. And so then the Jebusites grew so that pretty soon the city became a city of the Jebusites. That's what Matthew Henry says. So you see how complicated the history of Jerusalem is, the ancient history of it. So let's go back through some scriptures here. In Joshua 15:8, we see the border of Judah described. From there, the border of Judah ascended the valley of Hinnom to the southern Jebusite slope, that is Jerusalem. Well, the valley of Hinnom runs right up, well, right south of the city of David, of that projecting hill that looks like the state of California sticking down into the junction of the Tyrrhenian and Kidron Valley. The valley of Hinnom is right there at the intersection at the south. So you see, Judah has already got a border that's in the south of Jerusalem, near the valley of Hinnom. And Joshua continues, the border ascended to the top of the hill that faces the valley of Hinnom on the west and the northern end of the valley of Rephaim. Well, we'll talk about the valley of Rephaim in just a minute, but that's a valley that runs northeast to southwest, about 3 miles west of Jerusalem. So this border in Joshua 15 is a little bit confusing, but the idea is it runs right around the south and then runs up to the west, up to the north. So it's right in there in the area of Jerusalem. And then in Joshua 18:28, we see Jebus, that is Jerusalem, was the inheritance for Benjamin's descendants. So you see, Benjamin got Jerusalem too in Joshua 18:28. And then in Judges 1:8, the men of Judah fought against Jerusalem and captured it. They put the city to sword and set it on fire. So Joshua gave them the land. Of course, they have to take the city once the land is allotted to them. And they did so. Judah did. They got their portion in Judges 1:8. And then in Judges 1:21, we read this. At the same time, the Benjaminites did not drive out the Jebusites who were living in Jerusalem. The Jebusites have lived among the Benjamites in Jerusalem to this day. Okay, so that's at the beginning of Judges. We see Benjaminites there. We see Jebusites there. We see the men of Judah there. But now, about 100 years later or so, at the end of the period of Judges, at the beginning of the kingdom, the monarchy, David is faced with taking Jerusalem again, the city of the Jebusites. How did they get it? Judah already had it in Judges 1:8. At the beginning of the century, the 11th century B.C., now at the end of the 11th century B.C., they don't have it. Adam Clark says this, Jerusalem was now in the hands of the Jebusites. But how they got possession of it is not known. Probably they took it during the wars between Ishbosheth and David. After Joshua's death, what is called the Lower City was taken by the Israelites. I just read you that. And it is evident that the whole city was in their possession in the time of Saul, for David brought the head of Goliath thither. So David took the head of Goliath to Saul at Jerusalem, so the Israelites had Jerusalem. But then they lost it somehow between Saul and David. And now David's got to go back and retake Jerusalem. So that's where we are here. Now the men of Jebus, the Jebusites, said to David, "You shall not come in here, but the blind and lame will turn you away." Probably got up on the side of the hill. And if you look at the hill, I've been there, looked from the Kidron Valley, looked at the city of David, Zion, Mount Zion, that hill there. Man, that's a steep hill. That's hard to get into. And so the men of Jerusalem, presently occupying it, the Jebusites said, "David, you're not going to come in here. The blind and lame will turn you away." Thinking, David cannot enter here. They were pretty cocky about their stronghold, kind of like the people of Byzantium thought the Muslims would never get it, but they did, because of the high walls around the city. Now, what did they mean, the blind and the lame are not going to take the city? The Jewish rabbis say that's referring to the idols of the Jebusites. The blind and the lame can defend this place. The blind and the lame idols will turn you away, David. I don't think so. I tell you, these rabbis have got a great imagination. I think Adam Clark is right. The Jebusites were saying that a few blind and lame men could defend the fortified city. That's all it takes. Blind men, cripples, can stop you, David, because of our strong fortifications. David later on in verse 8 says, "Take the Jebusites, let them reach the lame and the blind who are hated by David's soul." Why are they hated? Well, because they were mocking David, making fun of him. Okay, I'm going to go get you, lame and blind. You think you're so strong that even the blind and the lame can defend against me? Well, I'm going to go get you. and I'm going to call you blind and lame. I'm going to turn your taunt around on you. Nevertheless, David captured the stronghold of Zion, that is the city of David. In other words, despite the fact that even blind and lame man could defend that fortified hill of Zion, nevertheless, David got it. Now, Zion is called the city of David. Why? Well, because he conquered it. He lived there. His capital was there. Now, the hill of Zion. Now, this is interesting. Of course, we know that Zion is a symbol of Jerusalem, the kingdom of God, symbolically. But I'm talking about geographically. Where is the city of Zion? And I spent a good part of my adult life wondering where it was. And I finally found out, I think it was through Wikipedia or somewhere, that there's been confusion about where Zion is forever. And unfortunately, all the commentators I use are old commentators, and they were in the midst of the confusion, and they confused me. For example, here's Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. Whether Zion be the southwestern hill, commonly so-called the western hill, that's not right. Zion is not the southwestern hill of Jerusalem, but it was commonly so-called that. Or, Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown continue, or if Zion is the peak now, level on the north of the Temple Mount, folks, Mount Zion is not north of the Temple Mount. Easton's Dictionary has it right. They say that Zion, which means sunny or height, was one of the eminences on which Jerusalem was built. It was surrounded on all sides except the north by deep valleys. The Tyre Pineian is on the west side of this hill. The south and the hill itself was the southeastern hill of Jerusalem, and that's exactly right. Wikipedia says that in the Middle Ages, the term referred to a hill south of the Temple Mount. Well, it's south and west, actually. Here's what BiblePlaces.com says. The modern Mount Zion is a misnomer applied by Byzantine pilgrims who thought that the larger, flatter western hill must be the original city of David. Archaeological evidence has shown that this hill was only incorporated within the city's fortifications in the 8th century B.C., the western hill. But the name is stuck. So a lot of times people talk about Mount Zion, they're talking about a hill on the west of Jerusalem, west of the Tyre Pineian Valley. No, it's not. I have a map here. In fact, they call that western hill New Mount Zion, I guess, just to distinguish it. So let's look at Mount Zion. This is so famous, you really need to know the geography of this. I'm looking at an aerial photograph right now of Mount Zion. If you'll look at the city of Jerusalem, there's a long, elongated projection from the Temple Mount. Well, let's start from there, since the famous temple to Al-Aqsa Mosque is on it now, the Dome of the Rock, but it used to be where the temple was, where Solomon's the second temple was, Herod's temple. And so that's the Temple Mount right there. And if you go southeast, adjoining, butting up on the Temple Mount, you're at Mount Ophel. And then if you go straight south from Mount Ophel, you go along the top of a mountain ridge, that's Mount Zion. It goes from Mount Ophel all the way down to the intersection of the Kidron Valley and the Tyre Pineian Valley. The Tyre Pineian Valley is to the west of the hill of Mount Zion. The Kidron Valley is to the east, surrounding it. And, of course, the Valley of Hinnom is at the intersection of those two valleys right at the south. So the city of David, or Mount Zion, the true Mount Zion, kind of looks like the state of California if you draw a border around it. We go now to 2 Samuel 5:8. David said on that day. What he means is on the day that they were thinking about taking the Jebusites. Verse 8 is out of time order. Verse 7, it says David captured the city of Jerusalem. And then in verse 8, it talks about how he did it. That happens all the time. You go from one verse to the next. It's slightly out of chronological order because the author wants to capitulate something that happened, tell you about it, and then he wants to go back and say, this is how it happened. So David said on that day, whoever would strike the Jebusites, let him reach the lame and the blind who are hated by David's soul through the water tunnel. Therefore, they say, the blind or the lame shall not come into the house. We found out from 1 Chronicles 11:6 that the person who struck the Jebusites first and got the city shall be made chief and commander, 1 Chronicles 11:6. Who got it? Joab, the son of Zeruiah, that's David's sister. David's nephew Joab, the famous Joab who's killed Abner, he went up first, so he became chief. So apparently he had been demoted earlier for killing Abner, but then he got his head of the Joint Chiefs of Staff of Israel, got it back by attacking Jerusalem and beating the Jebusites. And that's not surprising. Joab was the number one military guy in Israel. So David had to put up with him, even though I'm sure he hated his guts, but he had to put up with him because he was such a good general. David says in verse 8, let this person who first strikes the Jebusites reach the lame and the blind. Of course, he's being sarcastic there about the taunt that the Jebusites had thrown at him, that even the lame and blind could defend Jerusalem. Let this first military guy reach him, the lame and the blind, who were hated by David's soul. Well, that could be they were idols, lame and the blind, as the Jews say. Of course, David would hate idols. Or it could be the people of Jerusalem are hated by David's soul. None of this love your enemy stuff in the Old Testament. And so David suggests the way to get into Jerusalem is through the water tunnel. Now, there's a lot of different translations for that Hebrew word. The NIV says the water shaft. The NIV note says it could be the scaling hooks. Let him get into Jerusalem using scaling hooks. John Gill translates it as through the gutter. John Gill says it could be translated as a water spout, which carries water from the roofs into the cisterns. John Gill says it could be the ditch. John Gill says it could be a pipe. So the Hebrew word is a little bit fuzzy. Dio Cassius, the famous Roman historian, speaks of several tunnels through which the Jews escaped in the destruction of Jerusalem in AD 70. I think about Gihon, that famous spring. It was outside the walls right there, halfway down the hill there toward the Kidron Valley. And the spring ran through a tunnel, and then they dug it such that it would go under the wall. Well, actually, they dug it. Well, the spring itself was covered underground, and then it would go through the ground and then under the wall of Jerusalem that the Israelites built, and then it would be collected in the pool of Siloam, I think it was, in the southern end of Israel, and so they had a water supply, and so attackers couldn't get their water. That's a famous place somewhere. I talk about the pool of Gihon in some audio I did somewhere buried in these mountains of audio that I've been doing. It was very interesting to study that tunnel, but at any rate, that's how the Israelites took Jerusalem, through a water tunnel. We go now to 2 Samuel. Well, let me back up a minute. A proverb was made about this lame and blind business. Therefore they say, I guess that's the Jebusites say, the blind or the lame shall not come into the house. Is that the Jebusites that made that proverb, looking at some dipstick Jebusite and saying, hey, you're such a worthless, pathetic braggart. You said the blind and the lame shouldn't come into the house, but you let them in. That they would be making fun of themselves then, or maybe the Israelites said, oh, the blind and the lame not going to come into this house, ha, 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 but look at us, we won. Anytime they wanted to taunt somebody who thought they were superior to the Israelites. I don't know where that proverb spread to. We go now to 2 Samuel 5, 9 and 10. So David lived in the stronghold and called it the City of David, that little strip of land that looks like California on the mountain ridge between the Tyre Pean and the Kidron Valley. That's the City of David, it's Mount Zion. And David built all around from the millow and inward. David became greater and greater, for the Lord God of hosts was with him. By the way, I think I pronounced that Tyropoean Valley as Tyropoean Valley to the west. Now, David fortified this hill, this ridge, from the millow and inward. Now, nobody knows what the millow is. I'm going to give you some speculations here. This is from John Gill. It's supposed to be a ditch around the fort full of water. So he says it's a ditch around a fort, or it was a large hollow place which divided the fort from the lower city, the fort being on the northern end of Mount Zion, right below Mount Ophel. Gill goes on to say, afterward Solomon filled this hollow place up and made it level, and therefore it is called here by anticipation. But another Jewish rabbi named Jarchi says, no, it was done by David. Again, nobody knows. Dr. Lightfoot, the famous Lightfoot of the Westminster Assembly, he says it was a part of Zion or some hillock east up against it on the west side, whatever east up against it means. In other words, on the west side, on the west side of Mount Zion, but the eastern edge of Millo is butting up on Mount Zion. Well, that's a speculation. Lightfoot said, or Gill contingents say that Millo is a fortress or a citadel. Easton says that the Millo is probably the Canaanite name of some fortification consisting of walls filled in with earth and stones, which protected Jerusalem on the north as its outermost defense. The reason for that would be because with Mount Moriah, Mount Ophel being flat up there, or being, I shouldn't say flat, but they're level with they're level with the northern end of Mount Zion. Mount Zion is protected well on the east and the west by the Tyre Pean and Kidron Valleys, and on the south by the Valley of Hinnom. Nobody's going to get to it from there, but it's got to be defended from the north. And so the Millo would be the fort doing that. Someone has speculated that probably the Millo was built to protect Zion from the Jebusites. The Jebusites still living there, even though they were conquered, they could still come back. Other translations have the Millo translated this way. The Holman Christian Study Bible, NIV, says the supporting terraces, whatever that means. The New King James has the landfill. So either it's a landfill, or it's a fortress, or it's a tower. Some people have it as a graded steps. Here's what Wikipedia says. Hezekiah's repair of the Millo is mentioned within a list of repairs to military fortifications. And so several scholars generally believe that it was something connected to military activity, such as a tower, citadel, or simply a significant part of a wall. And Wikipedia's got another speculation, which I'm not even going to get into. Let's just say it's a fort on Mount Zion, the city of David. Verse 10, David became greater and greater, for the Lord God of hosts was with him. Greater in, as John Gill says, greater in honor, in wealth, in fame and reputation, in conquered enemies, and in dominions. 2 Samuel 5, verses 11 through 12. Then Hiram, king of Tyre, sent messengers to David with cedar trees and carpenters and stonemasons, and they built a house for David. And David realized that the Lord had established him as king over Israel, and that he had exalted his kingdom for the sake of his people Israel. David finally sees Samuel's prophecy fulfilled after a lot of fighting, a lot of years of running around in the desert, dealing with assassinations, attacks by the Philistines. He's got it made now. He's living in a cedar house. Now this Hiram, king of Tyre, who built that cedar house with Hiram's carpenters and stonemasons, a couple of options as to who he is. John Gill says he's the father of that Hiram who lived in the times of Solomon, built Solomon's temple, or helped build Solomon's temple. And Adam Clark says, nope, this is the same Hiram that lived in the times of Solomon. So, see, there's either a Hiram Sr. in David's time and a Hiram Jr. in Solomon's time, or there's just one Hiram in both of those kings' reigns. Hiram interestingly shows up in the ancient Near Eastern literature, in the ancient historians of Tyre. His name was Abibalus, and Josephus quotes these ancient historians of Tyre. So anyway, Hiram's well known in history. Let's look at when Solomon hired either Hiram or Hiram's son. Now therefore command that they cut for me cedars from Lebanon, and my, Solomon's, servants will be with your servants, Hiram, and I will give you wages for your servants according to all that you say. For you know that there's no one among us who knows how to cut timber like the Sidonians. And remember, Tyre and Sidon are sister cities. Sidon is a little bit to the north on the Mediterranean coast. Tyre is south of Sidon a little ways, and then you go a little bit ways further. You're at Acre, which is right at the northern edge of Israel. Go a little bit across the bay from Acre, and you end up at Carmel, that little northwestern promontory that juts out from Israel into the Mediterranean Sea. So Tyre's not too far away from David with those cedar trees. I often wondered how they get those trees down there. Now, I'll be honest with you, I don't know. It seems like a difficult job, but I'm always amazed at ancient engineers, what they can do. Now, this house that Hiram built for David is called a house of cedar in 2 Samuel 7:2, two chapters from now. The king said to Nathan the prophet, David said to Nathan the prophet, see now I dwell in a house of cedar, but the ark of God dwells within tent curtains. So this is a magnificent palace, a cedar palace. Cedar's great wood. The water and insects can't touch it. The fact that David had to use Hiram's carpenters and stonemasons shows the low state of Israel, according to Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown, because Israel had to borrow craftsmen. They didn't have their own. This low state of Israel probably came about because of the Civil War. In other words, it's going to take Israel a little time to recover from all the fighting. We go now to 2 Samuel 5, verses 13 through 16. Meanwhile, David took more concubines and wives from Jerusalem after he came from Hebron, and more sons and daughters were born to David. Now, these are the names of those who were born to him in Jerusalem: Shammua, Shobab, Nathan, Solomon, Ibhar, Elishua, Nepheg, Japhia, Elishama, Eliada, and Eliphelet. Now, this story of David building a palace and all of his concubines and wives in Jerusalem is mentioned because David just took Jerusalem, but we're going to see later on that before he took Jerusalem, he was still down in Hebron, and we're going to flip back chronologically in just a few verses and talk about what's going on down there in Hebron before he took Jerusalem. But meanwhile, we find out about all the concubines and wives that David had in Jerusalem. He had 6 wives when he was in Hebron, so he ends up with 8 wives and 10 concubines. I don't know how many concubines he had before. I don't think anybody knows, but he's got a ton of them now. Now, was this acceptable or not? Well, it was contrary to the law, Deuteronomy 17:17. He, the king of Israel, shall not multiply wives for himself, or else his heart will turn away, nor shall he greatly increase silver and gold for himself. Well, the King David is increasing. He's got a house of cedar. I guess it was probably finely decorated. Wouldn't be surprised with silver and gold. Now he's getting a bunch of wives. This was contrary to God's original design, of course. We know the famous passage in Genesis 2:24. For this reason, a man shall leave his father and his mother and be joined to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Matthew 19, verses 5 through 6, this is also famous. Jesus quotes Genesis 2:24, and he says, For this reason, a man shall leave his father and mother and be joined to his wife, not his wives, but his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. So they are no longer two, but one flesh. What therefore God has joined together, let no man separate, as the old wedding vows used to say. Those wedding vows which are increasingly violated over and over again, even by people in the church. John Gill says taking all these wives was not to David's honor. Clark and Jameson Foster Brown agree with that. They don't like what David did. Now, the NIV Study Bible looks into the question of why did David take so many wives? Well, here's several options. Option one, he just adapted himself to his cultural surroundings. Polygamy was a common practice at that time. Well, of course, that doesn't excuse David, but that helps explain why he did it. Second reason why David did it, probably, it showed David's rank and wealth. The more concubines and wives you have, the stronger the kingship is. That's why they had harems. People think that all his concubines are so that the king can have all the sex he wants. That's not really why. In fact, a lot of times the harems are so big, the king couldn't have sex with all those women. It was because to show that I'm a big shot, I'm in charge here. Again, is that really what you want your king, the king of the theocracy of Israel? Is that really what you want? Third reason why David took so many wives, according to the NIV Study Bible, is that it was politically expedient. Now here's an example. David married Maacah. Maacah was Absalom's mother. And Maacah was the daughter of one of the kings of Geshur. Geshur is at the Golan Heights right east of the Sea of Galilee. And Geshur is right north of Mahanaim, where Ishbosheth, the last ruling king of Israel, was before he was murdered. Well, now Ishbosheth is encircled. Hebron to the south, Geshur to the north. So this might have been a political marriage. They're one of these marriages. So that's the third reason why David took so many wives. Fourth reason was, back then, at a time of great infant mortality, having many wives and concubines would help ensure the succession to the throne. I don't know if a son of a concubine would succeed, but a son of a wife would. You got eight wives, more of a chance you're going to have a son that's going to make it. Well, that's nice. But the downside of all this is all the family conflict, which we're going to read about to our heart's content in the rest of 2 Samuel. Civil war, rape, wonderful things like that that happened in David's family because he had so many wives. The application point to be taken here is don't marry two wives. Just marry one. And then stay faithful to her. Stay faithful to her. Don't ruin your life. Gosh, I've been watching what I call adultery videos on YouTube. And of course, they're good stories. Usually, not all of them, but usually they say, yeah, I did terrible, or my husband did terrible, or my wife did terrible, or I did terrible, and I strayed. And then it was hell for 2 or 3 years, but God's grace, and we got back together. It's very encouraging, because sometimes they didn't get back together, but they sure went through hell while they did it. All right, so all the names in verse 14 are mentioned of David's kids, one of whom is very famous, Solomon, the same guy that built the temple, Solomon's temple, David's son, took over the kingship after David died. The rest of these names are irrelevant. We don't know anything about them. There is a harmonization issue here. 1 Chronicles 3, 5-9 mentions all the names and adds two extra names. Another Eliphelet, so there are two Eliphelets in 1 Chronicles chapter 3, and also adds another name named Nogah, N-O-G-A-H. Why would those two not be mentioned in 2 Samuel? Well, it could be because Nogah and Eliphelet died without sons. They didn't want to put them in the genealogy or in the list of names, sort of like a genealogy. Or maybe there's a corruption in the names in the manuscripts, and manuscript errors, Adam Clark suggests. It doesn't really matter. One little minor point here is that Shammah, Shobab, Nathan, and Solomon were all Bathsheba's kids. Bathsheba, the woman who David committed adultery with and murdered her husband so he could marry her. He ends up with four kids by her. The first one, of course, died as punishment. So that means that David and Bathsheba must have gotten along all right after the horrible start of their marriage. He must have gotten over the guilt of having sex with her. Psalm 51, remember that psalm full of incredible contrition on the part of David. He must have gotten over it because he ended up with four sons by Bathsheba. We go now to 2 Samuel chapter 5, verses 17 and 18. When the Philistines heard that David had been anointed king over Israel, they all went in search of David. but he heard about it and went down to the stronghold. So the Philistines came and spread out in the valley of Rephaim. Now the Philistines are now upset because David has been anointed king over all Israel, and so that means he's a lot stronger. He was anointed in Hebron, by the way, so now we're switching back from our look forward to Jerusalem. We're going back to at the very end of David's 7.5 years of ruling over Judah and Hebron. He's just been anointed king by the leaders of the tribes of Israel, the northern tribes. Philistines heard about it, and they went looking for David. Now, you wonder whether David's old friend Achish of Gath, whether he was chasing David too. He has stuck up for David pretty good as David lived with him. Of course, David was hoodooing Achish the whole way, attacking allies of the Philistines in the desert without letting Achish know. One time, but Achish's courtiers, statesmen of Gath, they didn't trust David. So David had to, the first time he was at Achish, he had to feign insanity so that everybody would leave him alone. And the second time he was marching up to fight Saul at Mount Gilboa with Achish, and the other general said, "Nope, this guy's an Israelite. He's not going to be loyal to us." And they were right. And so Achish sent him back down south to Ziklag. So we've already gone over all that story. So maybe Achish is chasing, but maybe not. I mean, David has hoodooed Achish pretty good by now. You would think that Achish has figured out what David had done. So that would mean that all the Philistines are now coming. When it says they all went and searched, that might mean pretty literally every last one of them, every last one of the main leaders are coming after David. Serious business. Why were they coming now? Well, they felt that they had to move now. The civil war between Judah and Israel was over. Abner and Ishbosheth of David are dead. Israel is now united, stronger than it's ever been before. Not only that, David was becoming good friends with Hiram of Tyre to the north, and Tyre is right north of Philistia. Now, Adam Clark and Jameson Fawcett Brown say that it's obvious that David is consolidating his political strength now. He hadn't finished doing it, and the Philistines said, "Well, we better get him now before he gets even stronger." So David heard that the Philistines were looking after him. He's down in Hebron, so he goes to the stronghold. Now, what is the stronghold? John Gill and Jameson Fawcett Brown suggest it's an unnamed stronghold near Jerusalem. But Eastern speculates that it's a stronghold at Adullam, and I think that's probably a right. Albert Barnes, the commentator Barnes, he says it's Adullam, and he quotes 2 Samuel 23, verses 13, 14 to show that. This is in a different episode, but it says, 3 of the 30 chief men went down and came to David in the harvest time to the cave of Adullam, while the troop of the Philistines was camping in the Valley of Rephaim. That's the same strategic situation we got now, the Valley of Rephaim. David was then in the stronghold while the garrison of the Philistines was then in Bethlehem. So I think it's reasonable to say that David has fled from Hebron to Adullam. Now I need to look at the map here and tell you how that works. Hebron, of course, is about 15 miles south of Jerusalem on the road going straight south through the hill country there. If you go to Adullam, about 10 miles to the northwest from Hebron, that's where the cave of Adullam is. If you go about 15 miles northeast of Adullam, you end up in the Valley of Rephaim, which is a valley about 5 miles long, well, maybe a little bit longer. So let's say 5 miles long, about 3 miles to the west of Jerusalem, the Valley of Rephaim. So now the Philistines are to the north of David. David's to the south in his stronghold at Adullam. That was a cave, you remember, what David fled to when Saul was chasing him at the beginning of his exile from Israel. Now, why did David go there? Well, of course, for safety. It's a stronghold. And also, perhaps, to rendezvous with his men, to muster his men together to get ready to fight the Philistines. The fact that the Philistines are spread all throughout the Valley of Rephaim shows that they were very numerous. This was not a minor problem that David was facing. We go now to 2 Samuel 5, verses 19 and 20. Then David inquired of the Lord, saying, "Shall I go up against the Philistines? Will you give them into my hand?" And the Lord said to David, "Go up, for I will certainly give the Philistines into your hand." So David came to Baal Perazim and defeated them there. And he said, "The Lord has broken through my enemies before me like the breakthrough of waters." Therefore he named that place Baal Perazim. Now David inquired of the Lord, probably used the Urim and Thummim, asked his high priest Abiathar to use the Urim and Thummim, which of course was some kind of a divining device that was held in the fold of the breastplate, which was attached to the ephod, which the high priest wore on top of his robe. Nobody knows what the Urim and Thummim is. I often just to make it easier on myself, think of it as a white stone and a black stone. You ask a yes, no question, you draw out the white stone, the answer is yes. You draw out the black stone, the answer is no. That'll work here, it won't work later, I'll show you why, but you notice these are yes, no questions. Shall I go up against the Philistines? White stone, yep, go fight them. Will you give them into my hand? Yes, you're going to win. Now, David always inquired of the Lord before he went into battle. I did a little computer search on David inquired of the Lord, and this is what I came up with. 1 Samuel 23:2. This is when David wanted to attack Keilah, which is a town right southeast of Adullam, on his original flight from Saul. So David inquired of the Lord, should I launch an attack against these Philistines? The Lord answered David, launch an attack against the Philistines and rescue Keilah. And then two verses later, 1 Samuel 23:4, once again, David inquired of the Lord, and the Lord answered him, go at once to Keilah, for I will hand the Philistines over to you. So again, we don't know what the inquiring is. Could it be a prophet? Could it be the Urim and Thummim? But he's inquiring of the Lord. 1 Samuel 38, and David asked the Lord, should I pursue these raiders? This is the Amalekites who destroyed Ziklag while David was up there with Achish getting ready to attack Saul. He came back and found out his city has been destroyed by the Amalekites. And so David asked the Lord, inquired of the Lord, will I overtake them? The Lord said, pursue them, for you will certainly overtake them and rescue the people. 2 Samuel 2:1. Sometime later, David inquired of the Lord, should I go to one of the towns of Judah? The Lord answered him, go. Then David asked, where should I go? To Hebron, the Lord replied. So David inquired as to where he was supposed to make his headquarters as he was ruling the southern tribe of Judah. He asked, and then of course our verse here, David inquired of the Lord, shall I go up to the Philistines in the valley of Rephaim? God said yes, and then actually three verses later in 2 Samuel 5:23, so David inquired of the Lord, and God answered, do not make a frontal assault. Circle around behind them, attack them opposite the balsam tree. So I said the yes-no thing wouldn't work, but it might work here. David might say, should I make a frontal assault on the Philistines in the Valley of Rephaim? White stone, yes. Black stone, no. Should I circle around the Philistines and attack them opposite the balsam trees? White stone, yes. So all of that could have been done that way. Or it could have been God giving a verbal talk to David, but I don't think it was done that way. So anyway, David whipped up on them somewhere in the Valley of Rephaim. We don't know where it is. David names the place Baal Perazim. Perazim means breakthrough or burst or rent, a tear. Easton's dictionary says of Baal Perazim, Baal having rents, Baal having bursts, Baal having destruction, a little literal. The scene of David's victory there is called Mount Perazim in Isaiah 28. It's near the Valley of Rephaim. Well, we know all that. Why did David put Baal in the name? Baal Perazim. Baal is a bad god. Why would David do that? Well, I think it's because Baal was the god of the Philistines, one of the gods of the Philistines, and Baal was burst through. Baal has been whipped up on. Adam Clark says, Baal means chief or lord, so the idea is, this is the chief of breaches. I have really whipped up on the Philistines here, not referring to Baal the god, but just the chief breach. In other words, this is the mother of all breaches. I have really whipped up on the Philistines. Who knows? But David said, it's like the breakthrough of waters, like a river bursting through its banks. The Philistines were broken in the same way. And notice he says in verse 20, the Lord has broken through my enemies. He gave Yahweh the credit. He didn't take the credit himself. We go now to 2 Samuel 5:21. They abandoned their idols there, the Philistines did. So David and his men carried them away, carried the idols away. Now why were the idols there at Baal Perazim? At the battle, the Philistines had brought the idols with them to defend them, to protect them, to give them success, none of which happened. Gill and Clark says that it seems to have been the custom of other countries to bring their gods with them to battle. John Gill says in later times than this, the NIV Study Bible says at this time, while David is fighting, who knows. But it doesn't surprise me that people would take their gods to fight with them. Remember the Israelites did the same thing. Remember when Hophni and Phinehas, the reprobate sons of Eli, the last priest of the line of Ithamar, when they went out and got whooped by the Philistines at the Battle of Aphek, or Ebenezer it was later called, and the Philistines whipped them. They took the ark because the ark was brought by the Israelites to try to superstitiously help them win the battle. It didn't work, of course, because God wasn't really there. So that's why they carried the idols. And of course, when you carry your idols away, that's a perfect symbol of, we whipped your fannies. We got your gods. Ha, ha, ha. So they carried him away, and 1 Chronicles 14:12 says that David burnt the idols. They abandoned their gods there, so David gave the order, and they were burned with fire. Now, this is according to the law, Deuteronomy 7:5. But thus you shall do to them, to the Canaanites. You shall tear down their altars, and smash their sacred pillars, and hew down their asherim. Those are the wooden poles dedicated to Astarte. And burn their graven images with fire. And that's what happened. So David wasn't so law-like when it came to concubines and wives, but he was law-like when it came to smashing idols. 2 Samuel 5:22 through 24. Now the Philistines came up once again and spread themselves out in the Valley of Rephaim. So we got another battle in the Valley of Rephaim. When David inquired of the Lord, once again, he inquired of the Lord, probably the Urim and Thummim, with Abiathar the high priest. The Lord said, "You shall not go directly up, circle around behind them, and come at them in front of the balsam trees. It shall be, when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, then you shall act promptly, for then the Lord will have gone out before you to strike the army of the Philistines." The Valley of Rephaim, of course, is the same place they were before. That 5 mile or so long valley running southwest and northeast, about 3 miles to the west of Jerusalem. Notice that David inquired of the Lord again. He did not use his previous victory as a reason to attack again. He could have said, "Well, I beat him once, I go beat him again." No, he inquired of the Lord first. And of course, the application there is, look, you're going to do something, ask God about it before you do it, before you buy something, before you marry somebody, before you take a job, especially when it's a big deal. Probably should do it with small deals too, but ask the Lord, inquire of the Lord before you do something. God says don't directly go up, in other words, in a straight line from Adullam. I'm assuming that David's still at Hebron. Maybe he's back in Adullam now. But he's at the south. Should he go in a straight line up that valley of Rephaim towards the Philistine front? God says no. Circle around behind them, flank them, encircle them, and come up them where the balsam trees are. The KJV has mulberry trees, but now Jameson Foster Brown says this. They're not mulberry trees. Perhaps they're poplar trees. It doesn't matter. There's a certain amount of trees there that David would know about. And I think that's why he said, you know, David's a military guy. He says, yeah, I got a choice here. Should I go straight up or should I circle around? My scouts have told me there's a grove of balsam trees there. I can get them from the flank or from the rear. Should I do that? And he went, yes, no. Yes, no. He asked the Urim and Thummim. Now, in verse 24, here's where I have a problem with that yes, no scheme. God tells David, when you hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees, David could not have anticipated that. Yes, no. So I don't know how that was communicated to David. None of my commentators ever talk about that. I feel like there needs to be a book written. How does God communicate to his people in the Old Testament? But anyway, it could have been a prophet that came to David. David could have had a dream. Who knows? But the idea is David is to circle and circle, be at the balsam trees, getting ready to march. And then David's going to hear the sound of marching in the tops of the balsam trees. That would be a wind blowing through the trees. The trees go back and forth. It sounds like marching. Now, how could that advantage the Israelites so that they could win the battle? John Gill suggests three possible ways. First, the sound of the wind in the trees, the marching in the trees, would mask the true sound of the Israelites marching. And so the Philistines wouldn't hear the Israelites coming at them from behind. Option number two is how the Israelites could use this wind in the trees. The Israelites would march, and that marching would be heard, but also the sound of the trees would be heard. And so the Philistines would think, yeah, well, that sounds like the Israelites, but it's not really. It's the wind blowing in the trees. They're not really coming after us. Or option number three, it could be the Israelites hear the wind blowing in the trees, and they say, ah, the Israelites are coming at us from the front, which, of course, is not true. So the Philistines would then fall back right into the hands of the Philistines who had encircled them. So however it was done, God got what he wanted by using wind. Notice that nobody's free will was violated. But he got sovereignly worked and got what he wanted. That's what's so neat about God. He's got control of things, including nature, and he manages to manipulate things in your life to get what he wants, even though you can't control those things, nor can your enemies, nor can the devil. Now, this second battle in the Valley of Rephaim from the Philistines was perhaps fought with more troops than the first battle. Verse 22, now the Philistines came up once again. Jameson, Fawcett, and Brown. And Josephus, Jameson Foster Brown has probably got this from Josephus. Josephus says it was a bigger force the second time. But that's just speculation. You know, sometimes Josephus is a little bit fuzzy on details of the Old Testament. So we go to verse 25 and we'll conclude this battle of the balsam trees. Then David did so. In other words, he went up and encircled and came behind the Philistines from the rear. David did so just as the Lord had commanded him and struck down the Philistines from Geba as far as Gezer. just as the Lord, I like that, just as the Lord commanded him. He didn't deviate. He didn't go to the left. He didn't go to the right, like Saul was always doing. He listened to God and did what God told him. David was very careful not to do anything outside of the will of God until he murdered Uriah the Hittite and took Uriah's wife Bathsheba. But up to now, he was very careful about obeying God's will. And so the Philistines were struck, and so from Gezer to Geba, or from Geba to Gezer. Well, if we look at the Valley of Rephaim and go maybe 15 miles to the west out of the hill country down to the plains, halfway to the Mediterranean Sea is the town of Gezer. And then if you go back 20 miles or so to the west, a little southwest a little bit, hit Jerusalem, and then you go north of Jerusalem about 7 or 8 miles, you hit Geba. Now, Geba is real easy to confuse with Gibeon, which we shouldn't do that. Gibeon is a famous city, shows up lots of times in Old Testament history. It is to the northwest of Jerusalem. Gibeon is to the just 3 miles or so to the north of Jerusalem. And Geba is to the about 5 or 6, 7 miles to the northeast of Jerusalem. So if you add Jerusalem, you go up 2 or 3 miles and take Gibeon as the southern end of a triangle, the southern tip, southern point of a triangle, and the upper left point is Gibeon, and the upper right point is Geba. You got the Gibeon, Geba, Gibeah triangle. I just made that up, but that's how you distinguish those three towns. Gibeah, of course, was the hometown of Saul and where the capital of the northern kingdom of Israel was. Gibeon is the town that made that false treaty with Joshua by pretending to be from a long way off outside of the land of Canaan. Important because Joshua had a divine imperative to wipe out the men, women, and children of all the cities of Canaan. And so they said, hey, we're not Canaanites. You can make a treaty with us. That's the famous Gibeon. Also, the tabernacle was kept there for a long time, too, until David took it to Jerusalem. So Gibeon's a well-known place. Geba was mentioned when Joshua attacked the alliance of five southern Canaanite kings who came up to Gibeon after Gibeon had made that false treaty with Joshua, and Joshua had to go relieve Gibeon. I think if I remember correctly, Geba was mentioned in that battle. I don't know what else happened there, but it's just a place name that we need to remember to distinguish it from Gibeah and Gibeon. But anyway, David whooped up on them from Gezer way over here 20 miles or so to the 25 miles to the east of Geba. So in that 20-25 mile radius, he destroyed the Philistines. And so, ladies and gentlemen, we are now finished with another victory for David. We're now prepared to go to chapter 6, verses 1 through 23, and we will see that in the time of peace, in the afterglow of victory, the ark is brought from Kiriath-Jearim to Jerusalem. Kiriath-Jearim is about 7 or 8 miles to the northwest of Jerusalem. It's a famous story. Hope you stay tuned for that story, and I hope you enjoyed this audio.